Okay, so I should say just before we begin that we should hope that the learning will be a for the refuah of Melpachino, Moshe Ben Sion Ben Leah Rachel. Since he was attending the class, hopefully he'll catch it online.
I'm sorry, I don't mean to.
Things are improving. That's
they
what
are.
there were some been some updates.
Uh-huh. Okay.
So tonight we're going to talk about good and evil. We'll start with Rav Soloveitchik, and
hi.
The Rav approaches this question really through a question about human suffering, and what kind of attitude we can take through it. In particular, is there a halachic attitude toward suffering? Right, so what would a halachic approach to suffering be? And what he does is actually divides halacha into two different sorts of approaches. There's a kind of, and he gives them different names, but the one is sort of he refers to it as the logos or halachic mind, halachic thinking approach. And as an example of this, he uses this example for both approaches. So Shabbat, from this approach, you look in the text of the Torah and it says, it uses the word lakadsho to describe Shabbos. So the idea is that you identify a certain period of time during which you refrain from certain actions. And it's very formalistic. There are a set of rules that you follow. I mean, if you've ever discussed one of the Rav's classes on, Rabbi Silver's classes on Shabbos or any other rabbi in the city, or taking a look at the halachos of Shabbos, you see it's very detailed. You can do this, you can't do this. There are debates, but there's machlokas, but there's still, sort of it's rules. You're trying to identify what was allowed, what's not allowed. And that's one halachic approach. The other halachic approach is experiencing halacha as an experiencing, halacha as a feeling. And the word used here is axiology. Axiology actually is the study of value, but it's the idea that in the case of Shabbos, we think of Shabbos now as not just a set of rules, but something that we actually can't capture with rules, something we simply have to experience. So there's an element of Shabbos that, now one could argue that you get to that element through following certain rules, but there is also a sense in which the two are distinct, where there's just a kind of experience of Shabbos that you can't get. Not to say you don't have to follow the rules, of course you do, but apart from that, there's an experience of Shabbos. In other words, one could imagine following strictly all the rules, going to shul, davening, not engaging in any of the negative prohibitions, engaging in all the positive prohibitions, and completely missing the point of Shabbos. Yeah, you can imagine someone saying, this could happen in the summer, we understand it, especially if you have small children, the day is very long, you're ready, they've got boundless energy, you're knocked out by 1 o'clock, and there's 7 more hours to go, that you're kind of waiting for, okay, let's just get this over with kind of attitude. But you could be doing everything that the halacha requires, and yet, you're missing this other dimension, this feeling. You're not feeling it. You're doing it, but you're not feeling it. So there are those two different dimensions. And in that second dimension, this halachic feeling, this is the quote from the Chumash that the Rav uses is, "And God blessed the seventh day and hallowed it." So as opposed to saying l'kadsho, keeping it separate or keeping it, giving it a certain quality, he talks about God sort of imbuing it with a certain kind of feeling. So in the first case, we are the ones who in effect make it a certain way by abstaining from things that we normally do every day during the week, right? So that first part, the following of the rules, I mean, you can think of it this way. We know that the Torah does not include all of the rules that we follow on Shabbos now. We believe that they were, in effect, their Sinaitic principles that were then, transmitted orally and eventually codified and written down, redacted. But we, in effect, create this given the way that we live our lives now, that there are 6 days that we engage in all sorts of work, and then we distinguish the seventh day. We do that by following these sets of rules. But Hashem has created in the Sabbath something we couldn't have given it, that sense, that uniqueness, that we are given the privilege of experiencing, but we can easily miss. But that's the two different, the Rav thinks both of those are elements of what he calls halachic creativity, two different levels of it. So now how do we apply these to the problem of suffering? And just a bit of background to this, you should probably all know, one of the long-standing perennial philosophical problems is the problem of evil. So leaving aside those who think discussions of God and questions like the problem of evil don't belong in philosophy, those numbers are dwindling. There might be a few of them still out there. Once they have tenure, it's hard to get rid of them. But even, you know, sort of hardcore contemporary analytic philosophers, contemporary Anglo-American philosophers still deal with this question. There's a lot written on philosophy of religion by American philosophers who are not particularly religious, but recognize this as a perennial problem. So how do you explain evil? So throughout the history of philosophy, especially among religious philosophers, various answers have been given. So one common answer, or one well-known answer, I should say, Augustine gave, was that evil doesn't actually exist. Right, so there's nothing that was created, because the big question is, well, how could God create something that's evil? If everything that exists God created, how could God create something evil? So Augustine argued that, well, everything God creates is good. Evil is a corruption. But everything that is corrupted had to be good, otherwise it wouldn't be corruptible.
Isn't that a personal choice of the person who chooses to be evil?
Well, yes. So evil is a lack of something, right? So it's a turning away from God. Something is missing. And in our tradition, we see the similar idea, I think you could say, in the concept of tuma, right? Which is usually translated as impurity. But it's really a lack. Something is missing. Holiness is gone, right? So that's, you know, one way of addressing this. Well, evil doesn't really exist. Another way, St. Thomas Aquinas argued, well, evil exists for God to make something good out of it. That's challenging because, well, then there actually is something called evil that God is able to change into good. But then how did that evil get there in the first place? So all these questions come up.
Well, I'm sorry, Richard. Just going back to what you just said about evil being, I don't know if you said it, but I learned and studied it as the absence. Good.
Right, a lack, right, a privation, yeah.
Not that it was something, but if you don't follow what we all accept as goodness, then you're not a good person, you are...
Yeah, something is lacking in you, right? Mm-hmm. So obviously we're all lacking something because we're not perfect, but at a certain point one could argue it becomes evil as opposed to just, you know, a normal lack of something. And God, since God is perfect, God lacks nothing, so God could not be the cause of anything that in and of itself is lacking something. Augustine is the one that came up with this idea. He was responding to a tradition of thought, Manichaeanism, which he was, earlier in his life, was influenced by, but then came to reject. The Manichaeans were dualists who really believed there was an evil reality and a good reality. We had two souls. The earth itself was inherently, anything material was inherently evil, and anything that was non-material was good, or all that was good was non-material. Mm-hmm. Augustine comes to reject that, does not believe that anything physical is evil, and comes up with the idea of evil being a lack of something. So, as I mentioned a few minutes ago, the Rav approaches the question of evil through a discussion of suffering. So, what is our approach to suffering? How are we supposed to understand it? So, there are actually two approaches. There is the idea that we can think of evil as, we can write it off. It's not really there.
It's there.
And we can, right, so that's going to be the other approach. But this is the approach where one element of this is called transcendentalism. So we get beyond the physical. Once we realize that evil is something we perceive in the physical realm and that we see evil as a kind of a limit, we transcend that when we die. So that, again, looked at through the lens of suffering, the greatest evil would be death or illness, right? Or even from our perspective, death, and certainly depending on when it occurs, but at any point in time, we think of death as something lamentable. But we see it from this perspective, the transcendental perspective is, it's an entryway into pure being, into true being, right? So when death is a way out of, you know, a more limited experience into an experience that is has fewer limits or no limits, right? And again, this is not a novel idea. Throughout the history of philosophy, we see this idea that our end is communion with the divine, and that's something we experience after we die.
And it's there in literature, the whole transcendental movement.
Correct. So this is that's one approach. The other approach is the other dimension of this approach, transcendentalism, is universalism. This is the idea, and many philosophers throughout the history of philosophy defended something like this. Well, things appear evil from our very limited perspective.
Yeah.
After all, we can't understand the entire, the rationale of the universe, the plan of the universe as a whole. We just see things from a very restricted perspective, ours.
Mm-hmm.
Ours is the only perspective we have. And we might try to see things from someone else's perspective, but it's really our perspective on what their perspective is. We really only have ours. That's the way we see things. And from that very limited perspective, one point of view is, well, look, you might think that a certain disease is evil, but how do you know that it isn't part of something that, you know, fits into the rationale of the universe in such a way that ultimately it is for the good? We can't see that because we're limited.
What about evil people who make you suffer?
Okay, so the existence of an evil person, someone acting, so what this covers really just suffering. So what's interesting is, what about this question of evil people? Well, that's easier to handle because there you say, look, we have free will. Now, not that this approach is without its philosophical problems, but we have free will. And Martin Buber will talk about the nature of that kind of act, what makes something evil in that sense. But we can say, look, that isn't, God didn't cause Hitler, Yamach Shemo, to do what he did. With Paro, it's a different issue, right? It's his free will. He chose it. Now, Buber has an interesting understanding of how he would describe it, or what would explain it, how we understand that kind of evil in action.
What would he say?
But that's not, we're going to get to that. But that's not God creating it. That's free choice.
How does the book of Job fit into all of this? Because God has this debate, and it ends up.
Get some of my nerves. I can't.
Oh, okay. It's my dinner. The rest of my dinner. Sorry.
Whether it's a bet or whatever, Job's family is destroyed as part of a debate, an argument between God and Satan. And then he is supposed to accept the fact that ultimately that he doesn't, what you said before, you can't know what everything God does, and so maybe you just have to accept that. And as a reward, he gets another family.
Right.
But I can never understand why that's part of Talmud.
The book of Job is interesting because here you have Satan, God's prosecuting attorney, shows up one day and God is bragging about Job, and Satan says, well, I know you think that he's loyal, but look at how wonderful his life is. Maybe if you make his life a little harder, that would be a good test to see, and I bet you that he won't be as loyal. Goes through all this. Job refuses to at the end, you know, after he is finally himself afflicted, right? Because at first God says to Satan, okay, you can destroy his property, you can destroy his family, don't touch him. Eventually, Satan convinces God, well, we won't really know unless I afflict him with something. He does it. His wife is the only survivor of all of this, and she says, curse God and die. You know, what's left to do? He refuses to do it. Instead, as you said, he wants to know. I demand that God come down and stand in judgment because I'm a good person, I shouldn't. And his three friends had come to, when he was in mourning, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar came to see him. And what they said is, look, Job, it's very simple. This is the way the world works. You do something good, you're rewarded. You do something bad, you're punished.
Mm-hmm.
Obviously, you did something bad. I mean, this is how it works. Job can't buy into that because he can't figure out what he could have done. And that's when you have the long poem in the, you know, I guess it's the latter two-thirds of the book, which some scholars say was never completed, but that you see this poem and God says, among other things, were you there at the creation of the world? You can't possibly understand. And then in the end, he does say to Job after restoring him, you need to bring korbanos for your friends, Bildad, Eliphaz, and Zophar, because they spoke wrongly of me. Mm-hmm. Right? They dared to say what my mind is, how the mind of God works. I have no idea. So it's unclear. I mean, so what lesson are we supposed to take from this? That because it doesn't make any sense. Why in the world would God allow Satan to tempt him, if that's what happened, to inflicting this kind of thing on Job? Because one response is, my students typically say is, well, wouldn't God know that Job was wait a minute. But now, if you're saying that God would know it, then Job couldn't be anything other than, then that means he had no free will. So it raises all kinds of, then you have to figure out how do you combine God's foreknowledge, God's omniscience, with free will, right? This is a debate that raged throughout the Middle Ages in philosophy. Different approaches to this, because it's a threat to everything we've come to accept. Of course God is omniscient, of course we have free will, but how do you bring the two together? I don't know how to make sense of that, what that tells us about this, except that, obviously Job believed he wanted a theodicy, a justification of what God has done. And the Rav offers his own sort of way of justifying it, although he doesn't really justify it. The transcendental and universal approaches really are, in a sense, I guess you could say, a justification in that, on the one hand, evil isn't really evil. It's our limited perspective. On the other hand, it is a way of just moving on to a purer being. That's what death is. And again, if we think of evil as suffering and death, leaving out human action, because that's chosen freely, but what's inflicted on us, right? When we choose a bad action, we're doing that to ourselves. But what's inflicted on us, that in some way we're supposed to, and we'll see this in a couple of minutes, that we can build on the suffering that we experience. Mm-hmm. Now, the other approach, so these two approaches, transcendentalism and universalism, are part of that halakhic feeling approach. So as an account of, and a halakhic approach to suffering, that approach of halakha we talked about with Shabbos, experiencing Shabbos, not in terms of rules, but in terms of some unique quality of the day that we can experience. That's the transcendental and universal approach. The other approach is, this isn't going to work. This doesn't work. The logos, more logical, rule-based, if you will, approach is, we have no choice, essentially, except to fight evil as much as we can. So the examples that the Rav give have to do with, again, suffering, illness. If we really believed that illness was just a preparation for us to move on to pure being, a higher form of being, then why would we intervene medically? We would just let things run their course.
Like, no. People do get to that point.
Eventually.
Yeah.
But we're pushing the envelope further and further and further, where we 30 years ago might have stopped much earlier, and now it's on and on and on. And that's because we think, no, we should do everything we can to resist it. Evil is not something, suffering is not something we should tolerate. We may not be able to get rid of it, but we can fight against it. This reminds me of, I don't know for sure, but I would guess that the Rav read plenty of Camus and probably read The Plague. And in The Plague, this is the attitude of the doctor who's fighting this plague in Algeria and says to the, in this discussion with a Jesuit priest, among others, that his job as a doctor is to fight against creation, right? Meaning suffering. That's what I do as a doctor. I fight against it. Every chance I get, I recognize this is the way things are, that this plague is a natural occurrence, right? This is a kind of unfolding of events in nature. But I'm not going to just stand by and watch it. I'm going to fight against it at every opportunity I get. That's my job. That's what I'm supposed to do. And that, in fact, is the approach of, the logical halacha approach, which is, we don't just sit by and watch as people suffer. We don't stand back and say, well, it's just part of life. We do what we can to prevent it. And we recognize that it exists. And we recognize the absurdity of the situation, because we're limited in what we can do. We realize we're fighting an uphill battle. We're never going to end this. No matter how much we do in medicine, we will never stop disease. There'll always be something. There's a new strain. So we recognize this is an absurd battle. We just have to, the best thing we could do, maybe some would say, is just, you know, try to keep yourself healthy as much as possible and just prepare for the inevitable. This constant fight, pouring research dollars in one sense, it's absurd because we're never going to get anywhere. We'll win one battle and go on to the next. It's ongoing. It's never going to end. We recognize it. Evil is real. So we reject, this approach rejects the universalism, which says, well, it's just our perspective. We can't really see the full picture of everything. So we think of certain things as evil. This approach rejects that. No, there actually is evil. There actually is suffering. It also rejects, and we'll see this a bit later on too, it rejects a kind of idea that suffering is something we should embrace.
Yes.
We agree that it's there, it is real, and we will fight against it.
It was reminding me of a lot of the Jewish American writers, particularly, who dealt with the question of good and evil, starting about the 50s and moving on almost up to now. And Bellow and Malamud, and even Roth in his own way, deal with this. Malamud's attitude is, you can take somebody who acts wrongly or evilly, whatever word you want to use, and the only way he is going to be transformed is if he himself suffers, and it's leading up to the last thing you said, and experiences the pain that he's inflicted on others and put into these situations, and there's so many examples of this in his fiction, and then emerges from that having an understanding, because Malamud's attitude is sometimes the people we call evil do not understand what it is and engage in it on a very base level. And not until they actually experience it do they then become able to understand what they've done to somebody else. And you have to immerse yourself in it in order to emerge from it.
Yeah, and the approach that the Rav is going to sketch out, and we're going to get into more detail on this now, doesn't accept the idea we can actually emerge from it. This is ongoing. But we have to take a stance against it. And we are going to have to bear it in a certain way. And there are two ways that we can deal with suffering. We can deal with it in the way that, again, very broadly construed, the Buddhist approach, which would be suffering isn't real, or, you know, it's something we're imagining. A kind of equanimity, where we're very stoic. We don't let it bother us. The Rav says that's not how we do it. That's not what makes us unique as human beings. Our uniqueness comes in the fact that we can bear our suffering with tremendous dignity,
mm-hmm.
and it can actually help to build us up, right? So that's the challenge of being human, is that we see suffering and we have to respond to it somehow. We can't give up. We can't throw our hands up. You know, going back to the plague, at one point later in the book, the priest that is one of the main characters in the book initially says to, as he's giving a homily to the residents of this town, this is something you brought on yourselves. God's punishing you for mm-hmm. being evil.
Mm-hmm.
But later in the book, he sees, after watching a 14-year-old boy die of the plague,
mm-hmm.
and the doctor is saying to him, that boy was innocent. You know, what did he do?
Mm-hmm.
The priest changes his approach, and later in the book says, it's the all or nothing. We accept everything or we deny everything. You can't pick and choose. If you want to accept God, you accept everything. Now, the question is, how do you accept it? Or you have to deny everything. You can't say, well, I'll take the good things, but I reject everything else. I won't believe in God for this, but I will for that. If you want to affirm the divine, mm-hmm. and you want to affirm that there is a God, you've got to take everything. If you deny one thing, meaning if you reject and say, I can't accept this, then you can't accept any of it. Even the good things, you can't say, well, I'll take God. Yeah, that's, you know, you're being a fair weather friend. I'll take the good, but not the bad. You've got to take everything. It's the all or the nothing. And so the Rav argues it's all, right? We are all in. We have to take everything. But how we respond to it mm-hmm. is what marks us off again as unique. So we don't respond with equanimity, with the sort of stoic, even-handed approach. In effect, we respond with anger. We do something with it. We try as best we can to respond, right? So this means suffering, not just physical suffering, mm-hmm. but again, injustice, right, that we would see. We don't just watch it and say, well, that's just part of the world, you know, you know, people who are suffering, well, this is just part of our lot. God will redeem us. No, we accept it. It is what it is, but we fight against it and we bear it with dignity. So even when we lose, which often we do, we lose a battle, we have to bear it with dignity, meaning we never give up what we are. We don't say, okay, I can't accept it. This is part of human life, right? That we not only undergo suffering, but unlike non-human animals, we're absolutely aware of it. Right, so someone's pet is old and is eventually, you know, starts to you know, slow down, get ill, and you know, at the right age begins, you know, to wear down and will eventually die. The pet might experience pain, but it's not aware of what's happening in the sense of, well, I'm getting old, I'm about to die. You know, there's none of that. We know what's going on. We see what's going on. We're fully aware. To not bear this with dignity would be, in effect, to give up that. Or to stand aside, not be willing to recognize it. In effect, to turn your head, put your head in the sand. There's really no way you can bear it stoically if you really understand what's going on around. We have to understand it. That's the kind of being we are. And therefore, the only way to respond is in a way that builds up our unique identity as human beings. And that's what the Rav means when he says we deal with suffering with dignity, not equanimity.
The other part of it is... If you want to build community, you have to look at it that way. It's not just a question of your own suffering and evil striking you. I mean, you may be able to somehow get through life more or less. You have some problems and so forth, but it is not of such an extent that it's going to devastate you. But other people that you know or even don't know that you see don't have that privilege. And therefore, if you've just taken it with equanimity and basically you're an onlooker, in a way you are committing an evil because you're allowing these things to happen to others.
Non-action, yeah, non-action. Being a bystander, just sort of saying, well, this is the lot, this is everyone has to suffer, or we're all gonna, as opposed to saying, well, no, we may not win, we may actually have to endure the suffering, but at least we're going to stand up.
Yeah.
At least we're going to recognize this is wrong. We'll fight against it as much as we can. Mm. And we have to accept, you know, this is where faith comes in. So we know that God will redeem us. Even when we lose, we will be redeemed. But we have to do something. We have to act in some way. We have to respond to it. And this is what it means to be in God's image, to live in God's image as if we are divine. This is the divine element in us. God does not stand by and watch injustice. God eventually intervenes as we have to. We have to respond, and that's the way we live as divine beings.
Yeah, and it's especially from what I have read over the years is very appropriate with the Holocaust when the question is raised, how could this happen? And they're not just talking about the evil that some have done, but those around the world who tolerated, who stood by and allowed that to grow. So it you know, works very well.
Yeah, the being the bystander, non-action.
Right.
Now, an interesting element of this approach, which is to deal with, and this is part of what the Rav calls the ethic of suffering. And this is, if you look under C, so there are three propositions, and they're listed there. Evil exists. There's no way of arguing that it doesn't. And again, this is in terms of suffering. We can't make peace with it or condone it. Right? We have to respond to it, act in direct opposition to it. And then again, the idea of faith, the third proposition. That even when we lose, we believe we will overcome this. At some point, it will be overcome. All those together, that's what it means to act with dignity and rather than acting with equanimity.
Mm-hmm.
And this dignity is revealed to us, and I guess you could say that this is what it means to engage in this quest which all human beings engage in, who take this approach, which is the quest for God, right? What are we after in life? The quest for God, right? And we could see this even for those who are not believers. We see this, for example, in Aristotle in the Metaphysics. The very first line of it is, "By human beings are by nature curious. We want to know." And this takes us not just to facts or bits of information, but ultimately the answer for everything. We want to know what the cause of everything is. What is everything? What it means to be. That, for a religious person, takes you to God. That's where the answer is. So the quest for God is, in effect, we are on this quest when we are responding to the evil, to the suffering we see around us. That's what we're, in effect, doing, right? By responding to this, we are making our way toward it. It's part of our quest toward God. But that quest comes with a kind of reaching out, but also a recoiling, right? So we realize that as we grow closer, I don't know who's had this experience, but I mean, getting closer and closer, I guess the more you are reflective of what you're doing and on this quest for God, trying to understand the fullness of the world, trying to understand everything, not just bits of information, that you're so puny, right? You're never going to be able to really understand it, right? So that's a kind of a defeat right there. What am I doing? I'm never going to get this. I'm never going to be able to understand this. It's too massive for me. I can never get my head around it. It's too much for any human being, any human soul to bear. That's the recoil. As we get closer, we become more and more aware of our finitude, our limit, you know, how limited we are, that we're not infinite, that we are finite, that there's only so much we can gather, only so much we can know. And therefore, we are sort of pushed back as we move forward. The closer we get, the more we're pushed back. And it's that drawing toward and recoiling that the Rav describes in this discussion of the quest for God. So it's a moving forward and then recoiling back as we get closer and become more and more aware of how limited we are. And really, that's what, in the end, it sounds like kind of a futile sort of endeavor, that the recognition of suffering, the response to it, this moving us closer to God only solidifies for us our limited nature, how small and puny we are. You wonder, well, what's the point of all of this? Well, that may be something we can't understand. All we know is it's just who we are. We have no choice. If we're going to live authentically as human beings, we have to do it this way. We can't really. I mean, in some ways, it is unsatisfying. I actually would say that people who can really live this kind of stoic ideal, I haven't known anyone who really is stoic full and full, all the way through, right? The stoic sage, as Epictetus would put it, who really could just bear all the difficult things that happen to the average human being with this kind of equanimity and not let it. I have not met anybody like this. And I think that's because it's just not human nature. We aren't willing to take it. At a certain point, we want to respond. And I think that's the, now how we do this, our reaction, rather than it pushing us away from God, not turning away from God, but moving forward closer to God, that's to react with dignity. One could go the other direction. This actually leads us into, we'll jump now, maybe go back in a few minutes, we'll jump now into Buber. Because now we're talking about the choices one could have in responding to suffering. One could say, move closer to God, or could back away, could turn away. So now Buber's focus on evil is action. Mm-hmm. And as you see in number two on the handout, that good and evil are understood basically in terms of having a direction or not having a direction, acting or not acting. And he talks about two stages of evil. So the first stage is, and this is, I find, some of Buber's most difficult writing. So in the book Good and Evil, which is actually two different titles put together, the first is Right and Wrong, which is an analysis of Psalms, and then Images of Good and Evil, which is an analysis of Genesis and also some Zoroastrian and other Asian myths that tell us something about, that Buber thinks tell us something about evil. He actually discusses, for example, the flood story. Obviously, this is not in the right order. He's Adam and Eve, the flood, and then Adam and Eve, Cain and Abel, the flood. And the way he analyzes these is very tricky, but basically, he discusses or describes these events as what, you know, what happened. What did Cain do, for example? Did Cain commit murder? Well, he killed someone, but he really had no idea that he was murdering anyone because these things didn't exist. So, you know, murder didn't exist at that time. This was the first killing. So what was going on? Now, obviously, there are different interpretations of what he was doing. The way that Buber interprets it as is as a response to what he calls the vortex of possibility. That at this point, anything was possible. And what Cain did was just reach out for something without making a decision. He analyzes Cain's action as really not an action that he decided on, but in effect, a kind of inaction. Just any, he could have done anything. In effect, I mean, if you think about it, his anger that we read about in Genesis is because God rejects his sacrifice. So what could he do in response? Well, anything, right? He could have done anything. He could have decided, okay, I'm going to learn from this. He could have taken any sort of approach, and he couldn't decide what he wanted to do. He lashed out. And if you think about it, when people lash out in anger, they often aren't really thinking about what they're doing. They're not making a decision. They're acting, but in a way they're kind of reacting. But reacting to what? Well, perceived wrongdoing, whatever it happens to be. But we call it lashing out because it's not really thought through. Right, there are many things you can do when you think you've been missed, when you're angry about something. But lashing out is a kind of, well, you haven't been able to deal with the fact that anything is possible. Meaning you could choose many different possibilities, many different actions, many different ways of responding. And it was almost as if that was overwhelming, and therefore you just lashed out. You did something, you reacted. That's how he describes what Adam and Eve did. That's what he did, how he describes what Cain and Abel, what Cain did to Abel, and that's how he describes the flood as well. What was going on in the flood? What was the wickedness there? It was just the lashing out. It was a response to omnipossibility. Anything was possible. And he'll describe decision as going in a certain direction, mm-hmm. right? So that's why evil is a lack of direction and good is having direction. Now, there are two possible directions we'll talk about, but another way of, a nice example of this that I was thinking of as I was reviewing for tonight is speaking of the Holocaust. So we know that, and now his name's escaping me, Eichmann, sorry, was captured by the Israelis, he fled to Argentina and was brought back, was tried, and then executed. And Hannah Arendt wrote a famous book on this, Eichmann in Jerusalem. And the subtitle of the book is The Banality of Evil. Mm-hmm. So the basic idea is Eichmann was a bureaucrat. He was a paper pusher. You know, I mean, what did he made everything run on time. What is it that he did? He gave up his moral authority, right? He was just doing his job, right? That was, I'm just doing my job.
The question is, did he have any to begin with?
Well, but he could have said, I mean, we see this all the time, right? How frustrating is it? And I always say to my students, this is one thing I will never say to them when they come, let's say, about a grade. I will never say there's nothing I can do. I can do whatever I want. I could decide, you know what, you're right. You should get an A. Here's an A right now. I can give the entire class A's. I can give the entire class F's. I probably have to account for that. But I can certainly do it. Mm-hmm. I will never say I can't do anything. I'll say I'm not going to do something. I'm telling you that I'm not going to. I don't think I should. But that's the assumption of moral authority.
Couldn't you say to them, if you do A, B, C, X, Y, Z, I'll think about...
Well, correct. But let's say it's after the semester's over. They don't want to do any extra work. They just want their grade to be changed. Well, you know, you might say, well, there's nothing I can do. The numbers are what they are. No, that's not true. I could decide, you know what, your effort is worth it. I'm going to get... But I'm not going to do that because it wouldn't be fair. That's what I typically say. Think about the other students. I should raise their grades too. And if I do that... There are no standards. I don't think it's the right thing to do. I'm not going to do it. How frustrating is it to go up to, you know, we've probably had this experience many times where we go to make a complaint at customer service, either a supermarket, wherever it is, and the person says, there's nothing I can do. Of course there's something you can do. If you want to make me happy, if you want to do something to make your customer satisfied, you will do something. When you say that, I remember a friend of mine, this would drive him crazy. Not much drove him crazy. He's a very tolerant person, very easygoing. But when people would say to him something like, you know, he once got tossed out of the gym at the University of Kansas because he didn't have his student ID with him. He was a student, but they made him leave because he didn't have it with him. And the person, when escorting him out, said, look, I'm just doing my job. And later he said, that just made me so angry. And his response was, you know, that's what the Nazis said. I'm just doing my job. You know, what does that mean? Tell me that you think it's right and I'll accept it. But don't just say, because to say that is to decide, I'm not going to decide. Yeah. I'm not making a decision. Someone's forcing me. I'm just a puppet. Yeah. I'm being pushed. I'm being told what to do. And that really is, I mean, if that's evil, I think Arendt's point is, if that's evil, then we're all guilty of this, because we all do this. We give up our moral authority all the time. We refuse to act. We refuse to take responsibility. And there's something very powerful in that idea.
You can take the opposite on that incident. He can say, I'm just doing my job. And the fellow would get angry with him. Your friend was furious. But the fellow who said that, if he didn't do what he was supposed to do, if we all did that, we would have anarchy. He was told, you have to make sure we have security, that whoever's in there belongs there.
Right.
And if you don't have that card, I have no choice but to escort you out.
Right, so...
But it has to be explained.
But notice the way of saying it. And really, it's when someone says, I'm just doing my job, and that's all. It's really a way of saying, you know, what are you saying exactly? Do you think it's right? Do you not think it's right? Say, look, the reason we do this is X, Y, and Z.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Lots of people would love to come into this gym and use it. But we got to make sure they're students. Mm-hmm. Otherwise, the facility will be crowded. You won't be able to use any of the equipment. It'll be way too crowded. We won't be able to manage. It's not safe. Go home and get your ID and come back. That's all I'm asking you. Everybody lives 5 minutes from the gym. It's Lawrence, Kansas, for God's sake. How far could you live? Go home, get it, and come back. I'm not banning you for life, but these are the rules. They make sense. This is a rule that makes sense. Some rules maybe don't make sense. You can't bring in a bottle of water. Maybe that doesn't make sense, so we'll let it go this time. Don't do it next time. But really, this is a problem we have constantly. People coming in, they don't have an ID, they're not really supposed to be here.
Maybe if he said something instead of, I'm just doing my job.
Correct.
If he said something like, if you don't have an ID, you can't be in this gym.
It's and the explain same thing, it. You know, not
number one
not
said.
Go through the policy in all its detail. But when someone says that, you know, you could say, well, they're just trying to get their job done and they just want to get you out, you know. Yeah. But it really is a way of saying, I'm not going to take responsibility. And getting back, you know what?
He was agreeing.
Well, but not system. He was only saying, yeah, but without sort of in a kind of non-thinking way. In other words,
alone.
He's a supervisor. He could decide, okay, I see everyone's kind of gotten upset here. Here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to write your name down and I'm going to verify it somehow. Everything's by computer. Or I'm going to tell you, look, I understand you're upset. You got to go home and get it. Come right back. We'll try to accommodate you on this end, but this is what we're going to do, because it wasn't just if you're going to enforce a rule, if you're going to do your job, of course you should do. You shouldn't just decide, I'm going to make up the rules as I go along. I'm not going to do my job. That would be in effect a kind of action without any direction. I'm just going to do whatever I want. Do what you think is right, but that's the purpose. Meaning, I believe, you know, these are the rules, and I can recognize why they should be followed. And that's what I'm telling you. Rather than using the language of, look, I'm just doing my job. Because when you're saying that, it's as if you want to be forgiven for something. Why should you be forgiven, right?
That's only one way of looking at it. Because if he just said what you said and said, I'm just doing my job, and stops, then it's up to the student to say, you have to explain that to me. I don't understand why you're not letting me in. But if the student doesn't say anything, he doesn't...
True. You know, that's true.
You know, this whole thing just happened to me because I worked for Geshe Latour at the JCC, but that's a separate entity from the JCC. And I've been working there 16 years. So we never, ever had cards. It was like, just tell them you work for Geshe and that's
it. And now they require them.
Well, I walk in there and I don't have a card. And like, where's your ID? I said, I've never had an ID. I've been here 16 years. And some guy's selling books, and he's like, we're going to report you to the director. I said, well, you go right ahead and report me to the director. Because I'm here to work with a student. I know I work with that student. I've been here 16 years. So my class, sometimes they're upstairs, sometimes they're downstairs. I don't know. I go upstairs, and now I'm coming downstairs. And I go in the room, and this woman comes up to me, and she's like, haven't you ever heard of, and I'm doing interpreting with this guy I do interpreting for, haven't you ever heard of Sandy Hook? And I'm like, why are you bringing that up to me now? You don't have an ID card. And I'm like, well, can't you see I'm doing my job right now?
No. You have to, especially now in this world.
Well, but again, you can, I mean, what the rules are is really a different issue than
how do you... Well, they went to my boss and said, you know, because I'm not a teacher, I never had a badge.
But how do you say, but the question is, how do you make sure that when you are acting, you're actually acting with some authority? We all should be able to do this, even if we are following rules we didn't create. Because
well,
you don't ask...
boss and they said...
Well, but you don't. But the main thing is you don't ask for apology. And I think if you look at this example, and
there, do you think that's a good thing or a bad thing to ask for apology?
You shouldn't. So, for example, and we talked about this example with Eichmann. But what Buber is saying again, back to it's really hard to understand with the stories from Genesis.
What happened in the end is they went to the principal and they said, "Look, everybody who's not a teacher, who's like an
right,"
AD
so
or
they
whatever,
set and again
have to
that's
get badges for.
That's so. There's a situation where maybe there was some confusion, right?
That's
they resolved it.
Yeah.
But the issue is, you know, they had
talk to me about Sandy Hook was like
they had a reason. They had a reason. It was maybe bad planning. They should have implemented this earlier.
Yeah.
But the idea is that for Buber, we think of he's again not denying it. There are people that act that commit evil actions. But how do we understand it? So lack of direction. Lack of decision, right? So not making any decision. Again, it's hard to understand. It seems pretty clear that, for example, Cain killed Abel. He was angry. But Buber says, no, this is, in effect, an inability to deal with all the possibilities that one has in front of one, to fashion a kind of identity and choose one path. It's just lashing out, lunging for anything, any
isn't
possibility.
Isn't it a lack of thinking about the other person? Isn't a part of it, I'm just thinking about me and how I'm reacting?
Well,
I don't see another person there and I don't care about them.
I'm going to read you a selection. I should have put this on the...
isn't that part of it?
On the sheet. But here's what Buber says. This is from the end of Images of Good and Evil, which is the second part of this edition, Good and Evil. So, for example, this is on page 125. If you can find, this is the newest edition, the one you'd probably find if you went to the library. The evolving human person I'm speaking of is bowled over by possibility as an infinitude. The plenitude of possibility floods over a small reality and overwhelms it. So, this is in a section of the book called The First Stage. The first stage is decisionlessness, right? Or being unable to make a decision. The second stage is wickedness. Now, this is where Buber says evil grows radical. So I'm going to read one more section from this. This is from page 137. From this point, the meaning of that paradoxical myth of two spirits, one of whom chose evil, not without knowing it to be evil, but as evil, is revealed to us. A few lines down from this, affirmation of himself and affirmation of the order which is established and eternally establishes good and evil, the first as the affirmed and the second as the denied. If he affirms the order, he becomes good. So wickedness comes about when you reject the absolute. That's Buber's idea. So there is an order of good and evil in the world, right? When you accept this, when you affirm this, then you are good. When you reject it and you affirm only yourself, now again, the background of this is that unlike every other living thing, human beings need affirmation. Non-human animals don't, again, they're not self-conscious, they don't need affirmation. So one way to react to this is to make yourself into the absolute, to deny everything else and demand affirmation by denying everything else. So rejecting the absolute, he goes on to say, this means he must deny and overcome his present state of being. If he affirms himself, he must deny and reverse the order which good had occupied, the position which good occupied. He must bring the principle of his own self-affirmation. Nothing else must remain worthy of affirmation than just that which is affirmed by him. So Buber says, for example, think of the most evil people in the world or those who commit the worst actions. Hitler, Yamach Shemo, he rejected the absolute, right? The very basic idea of good and evil, that you could wipe out an entire people or several peoples he attempted to wipe out. That's a rejection of the order. That's a rejection of the absolute, that there is an absolute good in human life. He rejected it. He rejected it in favor of something called the master race, Laban's realm, however you want to understand it. He rejected it. He made and said himself, the absolute. That's radical evil. That's wickedness. When, in response to the overwhelming possibilities, you don't seek out that which is the order, right? So the proper response to this is to find some order in all that is possible. That's the response, and that's goodness.
Yeah.
That's making a decision. The other response is to say, okay, this is chaos. I'm going to make myself the standard. I will reject everything else and affirm myself above everything else. That's wickedness.
So many things running through my mind now. And again, with literature, he could argue, Hitler could argue, or somebody as evil as he is, that you haven't defined your terms to begin with. It really is a good if we annihilate, eliminate 6 million Jews. In fact, it'd be even better if we could wipe out every single one and have a rationale on how that is going to better Germany and improve the world and point to all the problems that these people have done. And it's like attacking the snake in the garden. They are the snake. And if we get rid of it, we will have a better world. And there have been so many through history that have done things like that.
So your question is, well, why accept one point of view as opposed to another, right? Why? Well, one could say, look, that when we, the world learned what had happened, the overwhelming response to that has been, it is so far removed from the behavior of human beings and civilization. The overwhelming response to that has been, it's pure evil. Now, obviously, there are people that don't accept this, but look at them. I mean, let's be honest. Let's look at the people who would endorse that kind of behavior. Mm-hmm. Let's look at the worst kind of being. Let's look at someone right now, an example now, of someone who you could say is engaged in evil behavior, Assad, right? You know, either he's just really lost his grip on reality when he claims, oh, there's no civil war at all, this is all outside influence, it's not. And the fact that he would use, if it in fact has happened, chemical weapons on his own people, the fact that he would murder what they're saying now 70,000, probably more, probably closer to 80 or 90, maybe 100,000 people of his own, and he's not by far the worst that there's ever been. Look, the overwhelming reaction is this is insanity, right? We have to, you know, this is grounds for intervention. When are the world powers going to step in? The overwhelming response is this subverts the order of things. It's not just ordinary internecine conflict. You know, even the Palestinian-Israeli conflict, which gets ugly too often, but people recognize, look, we see the point of this. There are the extremes put aside. This is a battle over land. We see the point of this, right? There's two people competing over land. They see their identities in this piece of land. There are extremists for the most part on the Palestinian side. They are, okay, put them aside. But basically, this is a battle over identity. And there are, and this unfolds even within Israeli society. And there are other civil wars around the world where it's battled back and forth over territory. We might think it's foolish and destructive, I mean, more than foolish, it's destructive. But then there's evil. Then there's radical evil where someone says, like Assad says, I mean, who is he? Why is he entitled to rule? He wasn't elected. He's not good for the people. Perhaps, okay, look, as long as he could hang on, he should hang on. But now it's obvious that he should leave. You know, and there's reason to think he could get out with his life. But what he's basically said is, look, I'm the absolute. I reject everything else. Any other standard, I absolutely reject. North Korea is another example. I mean, who knows what's going on there? But again, it is. These are cases, I think, that where the Buberian analysis kind of makes sense, right? They've rejected the order of things and made themselves the absolute, and they're affirming themselves above everything else.
I understand. I completely agree, and that's how I would evaluate it as well. But I keep thinking in the back of my mind, if you go by numbers, and you have a society where the majority of the people can have improvement or more of this or that or are weak, and they'll follow somebody who either however you want to look at it, is evil or is just acting in an evil way, we can't just go by the majority. There are many examples of where
right.
a few voices, not a few, but enough to change things and to make a difference. So sometimes the order is not a good one with which you're starting, and it has to be.
But even then, you see eventually that these orders that would tend to break down. And you can look at the people who defend a certain position, and we see that over time, their arguments are, their viewpoint doesn't hold water, right? It can't stand up to critical scrutiny.
Well, we could see that. But in some cases, there are societies that started off erratically and in a destructive sense, and that part of the world or that particular society continue on. I mean, the United States is a good example of, from the very beginning, how the philosophers and the educators and the politicians were haggling over principles and look ahead and how is this going to develop and how that has to change and so on and so forth. So I don't know how to explain it, Richard. It's just...
But notice the endurance of the nation, right? And one could even argue, why has Israel endured what
Absolutely.
It's endured? Because of its commitment to the basic order of the world, one could argue, right? That mistakes are made by every nation. But the bottom line is there's a basic commitment to a rational order that is in the world that that reasonable people recognize. And those countries, I mean, the United States, mistakes have been made. No country is perfect. But look at how long this nation has endured, right? All the, you know, any brand of trouble you can think of, war, physical suffering, emotional suffering, financial problems, that we're able to endure this, right? The country has not fractured. All around the world you see other things happening, right? Where countries are coming apart at the seams over financial issues, for example.
Yeah,
and we seem to be able to withstand it, at least for now. God willing, it will continue. Maybe that's because of a commitment to, you know, a decision to commit oneself to the order that is there in the world. So Buber's claim is that there is, in fact, a kind of a sense in us of some order, a direction that we should go. Now, one of these directions, we can identify a purpose that we have, or we can just move toward God. Right? For Buber, either one is a possibility, but either one is manifesting the good. Right? So the basic idea is that evil is a lack of direction, good is having direction. And it seems to fit, again, nicely with this idea, again, that I mentioned earlier on in today's session, with the idea that evil is a lack of something. In this case, it's a lack of direction, right? An inability to choose, an inability. Even Descartes talks about this in the Meditations, Meditation 4, about indifference. That indifference is, you know, being unable to make a choice or claiming that neither matters. It doesn't matter which one I choose.
Well, that's the way people get pushed also to.
But that's the lowest grade of freedom.
Mm-hmm.
That's indifference. Real freedom is recognizing that there's only one right choice. It sounds, on the one hand, that's not freedom, but it's actually the highest form of freedom because you recognize that there's one right choice. I can choose anything I want, but I recognize there's one right choice. So in response to this vortex of possibility, anything can be chosen, but I know the right choice. I know there's one right choice, and that's the choice that I choose. That's the highest level of freedom, and that's the greatest manifestation of good.
Seems to me that you have to begin with the definitions also of what, and be able to work with persuading people of what is the nature of good or evil, because we know, and we know it from the Torah, and we know it
right.
from history. You know?
In one sense, I mean, I think it begins with something that's just implanted in us, a kind of, you know, reflection on what it is to be the kind of being that we are,
mm-hmm.
and what this means in terms of what's right and wrong. We get that. I mean, that's what it means to be human, be able to recognize, okay, I'm a human being, and, you know, in the same way that, you know, using now examples that Aristotle used, if you play the piano, part of being a pianist is to recognize what excellence is
mm-hmm.
in playing the piano. You know what it is. You don't have to be taught what it is. You just come to know what it is. The same thing is true with being a human,
yeah.
a human being. You know what excellence is. You can be led by example. You can watch you know, see people, how they behave. You can try to model certain behavior, but you've got to know which behavior to model, that's because exactly there's a variety of types of behavior you'll witness. But that, again, that's part of recognizing, that recognition of what it means to be a human being and what direction we should be going in.
Well, if you don't recognize it, you're not going to have human beings. You know,
correct.
If you affirm death and destruction and so forth, all you have to do is peer ahead.
That's right.
Look back, you know?
That's right. So that's it. Well, although we're small in number, at least in person for the last session, thanks to everyone for attending. I hope the class has been, the discussion has been enlightening and interesting. So.